burned down in the lobby through a hidden TV camera, saw it all. I would still you made it happen, took your random testing patterns, and I turned into my heart in nice guy. And your fully fixed perception is your secret style of something, and your bones all through that night. This little birdie told me who was talking to a fly.
This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Esker. Tommy, Tom Esker. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network, and this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Esker, here in the heartland, in the bunker, right here in north central Indiana, transmitting to the world. Resistance right here in north central Indiana on a Sunday. Surprise, surprise. Well, I didn't get with you yesterday. I took a little time off and did something I've been wanting to do for a long time, ever since I've been back here in Indiana, because the town where James Dean, the movie actor, was born and raised is only about 40 miles from me, and every year they have a big James Dean blowout. And I said, boy, this year I'm going to go. And I went, and boy, I'm telling you, what a blowout it was. They had everything that ever James Dean ever owned, the cars, wrecked cars, everything that James Dean had was at this place. And plus they had a big carnival. And I never seen so many Harleys in my life. They were like bees. I'm talking hundreds of Harleys rode in for that. You can hardly hear yourself think. I stopped at a gas station and you pump up, and a bunch of them were gassing up to take off. And man, when they were ramming those damn Harleys up, I could hardly hear myself think. Hey, we're at P.O. Box 401. Get that straight, Tommy. Wake up. Anyhow, I didn't get a show out to you yesterday, which you probably noticed. So I'm going to send you one out today because you deserve it. Yeah. On Sunday, the 28th of September, on Sun's Day. That's right. We're at P.O. Box 401, like I said, and that's where you send your donations for the show and for other things, and send your snail mail and any other communications you have. And that'll be fine, and we'll accomplish some things here. I got to get some money orders. I said last week, I think. I should have got those money orders the other day. I'll get them tomorrow for the prisoners. Got to send out a little token of our affection for our loyal POWs. You know, one thing we got to understand is we can't get all of our information from one area anymore. We got to get it from ourselves that we come up with. We got to get it from the left and the right. To be perfectly honest, on environment and a lot of those things, I get more from the left than I do from the right, because the right tends to be more jingoist and nigger. And we know all that, and we don't need to talk about it every second. So there's a lot of other issues, like the environment's going to hell and the warming up of the and changing of the weather and everything like that, and the danger of these nuclear plants. And here Japan just had another big earthquake. They're pretty big, and if it had been at the right spot, Japan would have been history. Yeah. A lot of people don't realize how precarious that Nakashima or whatever it's called over there is. If those rods that are trying to get out of that pool of water ever get together, they're going to try to move them. But if they ever touch, there's going to be a super nuclear explosion over there. Where are the Japanese going to go? What if they had to clear the whole island? That's a possibility with a nuclear meltdown. Where would they go? Where would we go? Look, the San Onofre nuclear plant that I lived about 40 miles from for about 40 years is dangerous. There's a lot of problems in that plant. They've had to shut it down numerous times. You got all that nuclear waste at Hanford, Washington. And you got these nuke plants all over the country. We've got nuclear waste down here in southwest or southeast Indiana that nobody wants to talk about until I bring it up. And they say, oh, I didn't know that. Well, I'll tell you, I wouldn't be having picnics down there in that area. It's southeast of Indianapolis. And then one of the most radioactive dumps in the country is at the area where the American Revolution started, Concord. That's where it's really bad. And it's all over the country, and they keep piling this shit up, man. So we got big problems, but the government of the United States, all they want to do is have little wars all over the place. Yeah, we want to have wars. We got to have more wars because there's a lot of profit in wars. And the more wars we have, the more it'll stir up the natives in those countries, and they'll flee, trying to find a place to survive, and they'll come here, they'll come to Europe, all over the place, and then of course we're angry because they did come here, and that's true. But what the hell? If you'd stop the warring and occupying countries all over the place, and always coming up with a dumb excuse for invading countries, these people wouldn't be running all over the place. So you can't have your can't have your eggs and butter too? No, that's not it. But anyhow, you know what I mean. And then there's of course the possibility of a sun flare out that could come and cook our ass too. So we got a lot of things to think about that affect the race, besides whether, you know, one black is dating one white, you know. I saw quite a bit, I was really a little bit upset at the James Dean get-together. I saw quite a number of mulattoes, kids, walking around. And that's something you had never seen when I was a kid. And the sad part of it is it's education. They get it from the churches, they're getting it to the universities, and they're buying into that shit. And it's a sad, sad situation. Well, let's see here. You know, old, what's his name? Rogue Progressive said something the other night. I tape a lot of this stuff. And he got pretty upset, hostile. So let's listen to what Rogue Progressive, how he unloads on the situation. He really unloads.
Have you, if you have any doubts about who runs the country and the relative importance of the three branches of government, here we are involved in what is an active shooting war. Nobody knows how this is going to turn out. Nobody knows what the terms are. Nobody really knows what the rules of engagement are. Today we were told during the press conference by the CENTCOM three-star general that we have another enemy, a new enemy. What the hell are they called? Co-something? It sounds like an investment firm. Where is this filthy, stinking, useless U.S. Congress? I mean, think about this. United States military launched an attack against a country last night. Oh, I know, it's against ISIL, ISIS, IS, whatever the hell. We launched an attack within the boundaries, the borders of a sovereign country on the orders of Barack Obama. The commander-in-chief does have the power to order these kinds of strikes if the United States is in imminent danger. So what was the rationale today? We were told, oh yeah, this Kobara, Kobanga, Kobuka, whatever this new group is, they were ready to launch horror on the United States. I'm not going to get into a argument with the U.S. intelligence service that was so able to totally miss the dissolution of the Soviet Union. They totally missed the attack on this country on 9/11. They totally missed the Arab Spring in Egypt. You know, the U.S. intelligence service is a bunch of useless goddamn fools who I don't know who they work for. I don't know what they're doing. I just know that the intelligence agencies that are supposed to be protecting this country they represent a huge sinkhole of money. They're not doing anything. You tell me, do you feel safe? Have you ever felt safe in your lifetime? As long as these thugs have been around, oh, they're great for spying on Americans. They're great for infiltrating human rights groups. They're great for surrounding people who are demonstrating for human rights or for civil rights or for political rights. But when it comes to events like we are involved in now, where's the intelligence community? They're the same place where this stinking, useless Congress is. So here we are. What is more important to these Democrats and Republican bastards? Where are they? They're home campaigning to get their useless asses reelected again. Everyone, Democrat and Republican, I don't care who they are. If they're not in Washington, exercising their constitutional obligation, where it concerns war, where it concerns what we're involved in right now, then they are useless. They don't work for you. They don't work for me. How many times have we talked about this? They work for the national security state. They work for the capitalists and the warmongers. I mean the 1/10th or 1/100th or 1%. They don't have a thing to do with your life or what you're about. Nothing. And they don't care if you live or die. The Congress of the United States. Where are they? Where are the sons of bitches? We're at war. Where's the leadership? Why haven't they called a special session of Congress? I'll tell you why. Because they couldn't care less. They've got their orders. Stay out of the way. Stay out of the way. Take your asses home and get reelected. Here's some money. Go play with yourselves. Where were we? We were talking to Guillermo. All right, Guillermo, we're back.
Hello?
Well, let's see what we can dig up here. Let's go back into the library and find a Sling Blade show here. Only this one goes way back to when he was Michael Myers. Remember that? Because they're not dated. They're all black cassettes. They're just sitting there in a box. So I just reach in and pick one out. So let's hear what he's got to say from I don't know how long ago, but I know it'll be good.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Ghost Wolf Radio. I'm your host, Michael Myers. Welcome to the police state known as America. Now, in the future, who's to say what type of police state we'll have? Will we have one depicted by George Orwell's 1984, which is like a boot stomping on a human face? Or will it be more of a subtle police state, like A Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, where you won't have a boot stomping on a human face, but the people who live in this police state will love their slavery because they'll be medicated, they'll be filled with bread and circuses. I believe we're headed more towards the second scenario. Be that as it may, we live under Zog, and Zog is not a nice person. You consider the carnivore program that the FBI had is snooping in our emails, replaced with omnivore. A lot of you guys know a lot more about that than I do, but they can read emails and this and that. That's not to make you guys paranoid, but you should always remember that these programs did not go away. Just like COINTELPRO didn't go away. They just modified it. Like I said before, our enemy is always evolving. On the next few shows, I don't know how many will take me, it may take three or four, I want to talk about a book called On Killing by Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, Jew Boy. The reason when I say that is because of his name, because of his picture I'm looking at right now, and the fact that he spoke before the Jewish war veterans in New York in the early 2000 years. And if you're going to speak before Jewish war veterans, most likely you're going to be a Jew. First quote I came across here is, where does this curiosity about killing, where does this curiosity come from? Robert Heinlein once wrote that the fulfillment of life involved loving a good woman and killing a bad man. Well, I wish there was white people who lived in Knoxville, Tennessee who lived by that. He goes on to say that there's more than one response besides fight and flight. We hear about that all the time. How if you're in an intense situation with a potential enemy, you get that butterflies in your stomach, that's the blood rushing out of your stomach to get into your big muscle groups, getting you ready for fight or flight. But there's also posturing and submitting. Posturing can come in the form of, you know, when you walk through a certain area where there's not a lot of white people, and either a black or brown is going to have a lot of courage because he's with his friends. Yo, white boy, what's up? What you doing around here? That's posturing. Posturing is also staring someone down. See, a fight, flight, posturing, or submitting. I've seen people get attacked and they just stand there and just take the ass whooping, thinking that if they fight back, it'll only go worse for them. Well, how worse can it get? Just look at the pizza beating at resist.com. Worst thing you can do is just stand there. Worst thing you can do is think that black people have any kind of mercy on you. They're incapable of mercy. Maybe to their own kind they can show it. But they have utter contempt for white people. I don't care if you have so-called success stories like Oprah or this or that. Deep down inside, they have contempt for white people. I see it in their face. I see it in their eyes. The first decision point in an intra-species conflict usually involves deciding between fleeing and posturing. A threatened baboon or a rooster who elects to stand its ground does not respond to aggression from one of his own kind by leaping instantly to the enemy's throat. Okay. So be aware of that. You got fight, flight, posturing, and response. Or posturing and submitting. Now, there's nothing wrong with running away to live to fight another day. That's only smart. If you're a white racialist and you're in a jam with four or five racial enemies, you'd be stupid to try and take them all on. I don't care how much martial arts training you've had. If you got your back against the wall, you better come up with some kind of weapon. Or just go someplace else in your mind, meaning show absolutely no mercy, and you have to dispatch them with extreme prejudice. Richard Holmes, in his superb book, Acts of War, examines the hit rates of soldiers in a variety of historical battles. At Rorke's Drift, wherever that is, in 1897, a small group of British soldiers were surrounded by, vastly outnumbered by the Zulu, following firing volley after volley into massed enemy ranks at point blank. It seems as if no round could have missed their mark, and even a 50% hit rate would have seemed too low. But Holmes estimates in actuality approximately 13 rounds were fired for each hit. That's that natural instinct that white people have towards killing, that the other races do not have. The focus of the primitive tribesmen on posturing at the expense of fighting in times of war is usually blatant and obvious. Here's where he talks about how, you know, savages in New Guinea or whatever, when they go to war against another tribe, they take off the arrows or the feathers off their arrow, making their arrows less accurate, but when they hunt, they can hit their mark with no problem. And his theory is that human beings have a natural tendency not to want to kill. I kind of agree with that. I think it's more pronounced in the white race. We need to understand why that is. This trend can be seen in the roots of the Western way of war. Sam Keen notes that Professor Arthur Nock at Harvard was fond of saying that wars between the Greek city-states were only slightly more dangerous than American football. I don't know if I buy that. Alexander the Great lost only 700 men due to the sword. His enemy lost many, many more. But almost all this occurred after the battle, which appears to have been an almost bloodless pushing match. When enemy soldiers have their backs turned and began to run, well, that's when most of the bloodletting happened, you know. For some reason, when you look your enemy in the eye, you have a less tendency to kill than if you were facing his backside. For some reason, seeing the agony of pain on his face and the shock of horror in his eyes while he's dying or about to die before you pull the trigger or kill him, it wreaks havoc on our subconscious. As we shall see, modern training and conditioning techniques can partially overcome the inclination to posture. Posture can be characterized by standing your ground. Posturing can be characterized by firing, shooting your weapon at the enemy, but purposely missing, firing over their head, firing warning shots into the ground. That's posturing. We of the white racial struggle need to meditate on killing. Now, hear me out on that. I don't mean contemplating going out and killing someone. I'm saying we're in a situation where our ass is on the line. You need to think about this and meditate about it, that you will absolutely show no hesitation, not shooting the wound, but shooting the kill. How many news stories do we need to come across to show that non-whites do not have the hesitation of killing us the way we do them? Hate and psychological inoculation. Martin Seligman developed the concept of inoculation from stress from his famous studies of learning in dogs. There's a story where he put dogs in a cage and he'd have an electric shock run through the floor. Well, after a while, the dog would become apathetic. Okay, he puts dogs in a cage, had electric shock pass through the floor at random intervals. Initially, dogs would jump, yelp, and scratch pitifully in their attempts to escape the shocks. But every time they would fall into a depressed, hopeless state of apathy, inactivity that Seligman termed learned helplessness. After falling to a state of learned helplessness, the dogs would not avoid the shocks, even when provided with an obvious escape route. Other dogs were given a means of escape after receiving some shocks, but before falling into learned helplessness, these dogs learned that they could and would eventually escape from the shocks, and after only one such escape, they became inoculated against learned helplessness. Meaning, you know, they learned a route of escape before learned helplessness set in. So no matter how many shocks they received after that, they programmed themselves to escape from that. And what did that? Action. Inactivity in the midst of an assault is your worst enemy. And that, and the four scenarios that I talked about, fight, flight, posturing, or submitting, learned helplessness can go right along with submitting. Now, the white race is involved with learned helplessness right now. We are burdened with that. I listened to the update message on the Aryan update line last night. It talked about some Africans taking over a plane in Africa, wanting to fly to Australia. And it's a little prop plane, and it definitely didn't have the gas to get there, but you couldn't reason with them. And that when they were getting low on gas, the pilot, who was an African himself, said, "Somebody back there, attack these terrorists and take them out. We're going to die if you don't do something." Well, they were frozen. The white race, and I don't know, I don't attribute it all to Hollywood programming. I believe there's chemicals in our food and some other things. We've become emasculated because we watch blacks doing Enzo dances after they score a touchdown in the NFL. I mean, we've been watching black boxers all these years, and What, we're emasculated because of that? That does not represent the real world. Yes, blacks are savages. We cannot trust them on the streets. You need to contemplate about this. If you are assaulted, that's why you need to train. If you do not train, you cannot trust yourself if you're assaulted on the street thinking that you'll do the right thing. Too many racials out there thinking because they're white, because they belong to this group or that group, oh, they'll be able to handle themselves. And they talk all this shit while they're drinking beer after beer at a certain social gathering. You don't know what's going to happen. And the way to make sure that you do the right thing is to train. You can have scenario reality-based training. You can have that on your own with a partner. Train down in the basement. Turn some of the lights off and have your, you know, you walk down the middle of the basement, have your partner attack you somewhere, and you respond. You know, you guys can get a hold of that them red pads you can buy in Century Magazine that the police use for red man training. You know, be creative. But you have to train to make sure that you do the right thing if you're assaulted. Don't think you're just automatically going to do the right thing because you're white. And how many times have we watched people of our race get butchered simply because they just froze? You cannot freeze in the moment, you just can't do it. And realize also that when you're attacked, or you're in a situation where you're assaulted, if you're a guy that carries a knife, you have to have a carrying system where you can get it in play without using fine motor skills. You know, there's a lot of lockback knives out there where you get the knife in your hand and you push on either a circle and a little cutout circle in the blade or a stud that's sticking out. That may possibly fail you in a stressful situation because that's fine motor skills. What's going to come out naturally is gross motor skills, big movements. You cannot unlearn what nature has honed in you over thousands and thousands of years. Try poking yourself in the eye. Your eyelids will naturally close. You can't unlearn that. You know, a few million years of evolution honed that into you. So, knowing about gross motor skills, you prepare and you train using gross motor skills and reality-based training. Get something here interesting. It says long range, not eyeball to eyeball with the sweat and the emotions of combat. Okay, long range killing is very, very easy. There's stories about guys in the Gulf War who were either M1 gunners or gunners on the M2 Bradley, and they're just lighting Iraqi tanks and armored personnel carriers up that are 2,000 meters away. That is very easy because it's just images on a screen. You don't hear the guys burning alive in the track. You don't hear the screams of agony and pain. It's very easy to kill long range. It's very easy to kill with the aid of a night sight or a thermal imaging device. You know, your FBI profilers like to talk all the time about serial killers and how they're cowards because they did a blitz attack on their victim, meaning their victim didn't even see it coming. They were just walking along and all of a sudden they were dead. Well, a lot of people find that killing someone from their blind side or from their 6 o'clock position, meaning their rear, is very easy to do because you're not looking in their eyes and you don't see the horror and the shock and the pain of being shot or stabbed. That will affect you, especially on your first kill. Some people, because they're psychotics, enjoy that. Says here, the eyes are the windows of the soul. And if one does not have to look into the eyes when killing, it is much easier to deny the humanity of the victim. The eyes bulging out like prawns and the bloodletting out of the mouth are not seen. The victim remains faceless, and one never needs to know one's victim as a person. And the price most killers have to pay for a close-range kill, the memory of the face, terrible, twisted in pain and hate. The price never need be paid if we simply avoid looking at our victim's face. It's very easy to kill if you don't look in the face. The U.S. Army, along with armies in many other nations, trains its Rangers and Green Berets to execute a knife kill from the rear by plunging the knife through the lower back and into the kidney. Such a blow is so remarkably painful that its effect is to completely paralyze the victim as he quickly dies, resulting in an extremely silent kill. This kidney strike is contrary to the natural inclination of most soldiers who, if they have thought about the matter at all, would prefer to slit the throat while holding a hand over the victim's mouth. This option, though psychologically and culturally more desirable, it is a slashing rather than a thrusting blow. Let me stop there real quick, because he said earlier in the book, I didn't highlight that, ancient armies in antiquity, they noticed that when they went to war with each other, when both armies are in pitched battle, during the times of swords and shields, their natural inclination was to slash and hack. And the reason why is because that is due, you know, and not just this guy, but other sources have said it, that is due to the natural inclination of not wanting to kill your opponent. You'd rather wound them. You know, soldiers from antiquity can survive a slash to the thigh, to the chest, to the back, maybe to the shoulder. That's why the army, or the Roman legionnaires, were ingrained, they were just inculcated into thrust their swords into the enemy. They didn't slash at all, the Roman soldiers. They thrust their, and remember, the Romans had short swords, anywhere from 24 to 26 inches. I think it's actually like 24 inches. And all you had to do was penetrate the body a couple inches, and it was fatal. So, and the Greeks at Thermopylae did a lot of thrusting from behind their shield wall. Okay. All right, so that's what he meant by slashing or thrusting. This option, more psychologically and culturally more desirable, has far less potential for silence, since an improperly slit throat is capable of making considerable noise, and holding a hand over someone's mouth is not always an easy thing to do. The victim also has the capacity to bite, and a Marine gunnery sergeant who is the USMC's proponent agent for hand-to-hand combat tells me that several individuals have told him of cutting their own hand while trying to cut the enemy's throat in the dark. Okay. Hand-to-hand combat range. An obvious method of killing an opponent involves a crushing blow to the throat. In movie combat, we often see one individual grab another by the throat and attempt to choke him, and the Hollywood hero gives the enemy a good old punch in the jaw. In both instances, a blow to the throat with the hand held in various prescribed shapes will be vastly superior form of disabling or killing the foe. Yet, it is not a natural act. It is a repellent one. It means one, you have to train over and over to do instinctually. The single most effective and mechanically easiest way to inflict significant damage on a human being is one with one's hand is to punch a thumb through the eye and into the brain, subsequently stirring the intruding digit around inside the skull and cocking it off toward the side, forcibly pulling the eye out and other matter out with the thumb. I'm going to tell you right now, guys, I don't think I can do that. I'm going to tell you right now, like Socrates said, you have to know yourself. I don't think I can do that. I can stick my finger in someone's eye as a distraction. I just want to get the eye, his eyes to close and start watering up, and that natural anatomic response for him to cover up his eyes with his hands. And when he does that, I can assault other parts of the body, or I can haul ass. I have no problem sticking my hand or my fingers in someone's eyes, but I don't think I have. I'm telling you right now, I don't think I have it in me to stick my fingers all the way through his eyes into his brain. If you have that capacity to do that out there, well, you're a better man than me. All right, the demands of authority. Okay, Stanley Milgram, famous case at Yale University on obedience and aggression, found that in a controlled laboratory environment, more than 65% of its subjects could be readily manipulated into inflicting a seemingly lethal electric charge on a total stranger. The subjects sincerely believed that they were causing great physical pain, but despite their victims' pitiful pleas for them to stop, 65% continued to obey orders, increase the voltage, and inflict the shocks until long after the screams stopped. And there could be little doubt that their victim was dead. Hunt goes on to say that they were amazed that the people who did the test thought that they were inflicting an electric shock on someone in another room or behind a partition. They weren't really shocking the people. The people that were screaming in agony were just acting. But they were really amazed that 65% of the people would obey orders to somebody wearing a white lab coat with a clipboard standing in back of them saying, okay, apply more voltage. Apply more voltage. Even though the people doing the shocking, the people that were being tested, were under great stress. In fact, some of these people that were tested needed to see psychological help after that because it really messed them up because they thought that they were really hurting someone. The demands of authority can get people to kill. Another way for killing is easy when there's group absolution. When you're with a group that's doing a bunch of killing, like the Macaulay soldiers at My Lai in Vietnam. How about the predisposition of the killer? Some people had no problem killing. Maybe because of the way they grew up. Usually kids who grow up by abusive parents grow up to be fine killers. Target attractiveness of the victim. Like I said, if you got to look in someone's face, it's harder to kill. If you're looking at the back of their head, it's easy to kill. Okay. So the demands of authority can get you to kill. It's easy to kill. All right. In these and many other killing circumstances, we can see that it was the demand for killing actions from a leader that was the decisive factor. Never underestimate the power of the need to obey. In many combat situations, the ultimate mechanism that leads to defeat is when the leader of a group can no longer bring himself to demand sacrifice by his men. Interesting. There's a phrase here: "Our blood, his guts." They said that George Patton was blood and guts Patton, and soldiers underneath his command said, "Yeah, it was our blood, his guts." All right. Some leaders choose to fight to the death. taking their men with them in a blaze of glory. In many ways, it is easier for the leader if he can die quickly and cleanly with his men and need never live with what he has done. One of the most striking such situations is that of Major James Devereaux, the commander of the U.S. Marines defending Wake Island. The small Marine detachment on Wake Island held out against overwhelming Japanese forces from December 8th to December 22nd, 1941. They started defending Wake Island right after Pearl Harbor. So, the last message sent out before Devereaux and his men were overwhelmed was received by radio telegraphy, and it simply said, "Send more Japs." Major James Devereaux fought to the death like every other Marine on that island. The heroism of the white man, just sometimes you, when you sit back and think about it, is just amazing. Too bad in many cases we're just cannon fodder for international finance and transnational corporations. They're making the world safe for corporations, not democracy. In such circumstances, this process of group anonymity seems to facilitate a kind of atavistic killing hysteria that can be seen in the animal kingdom. Crux's 1972 research describes scenes from the animal kingdom that show that senseless and wanton killing does occur. This is in the animal kingdom. These include the slaughter of gazelles by hyenas in quantities way beyond their need or capacity to eat, or the destruction of gulls, seagulls, that could not fly in a stormy night and were thus sitting ducks for foxes that proceeded to kill them beyond any possible need for food. Shallit, S-H-A-L-I-T, points out, and he was an Israeli guy who evaluated the combat psychology on Israeli soldiers after combat, and wrote a couple books about it. Shallit points out that such senseless violence in the animal world, as well as most of the violence in the human domain, is shown by groups rather than by individuals. Comrade Lorenz tells us that man is not a killer, but the group is. Shallit demonstrates a profound understanding of this process and has researched it extensively. All crowding has an intensifying effect. Well, you can read Gustav Le Bon's The Crowd and know that people are different when they're in a crowd than they are by themselves. How many times you've seen black and Hispanics? They're real brave when they're with their gang, but by themselves they're like fleety little mice. All crowding, this is Shallit speaking here, all crowding has an intensifying effect. If aggression exists, it will become more so as a result of crowding, meaning gathering in a crowd. If joy exists, it will become intensified by the crowd. This is one of the reasons why a lot of these evangelistic preachers are successful. Think about it. Picture a Joel Osteen giving some motivational speech from the Bible and this and that to only one person. It will have a different effect on that person than if that person was in a crowd of, let's say, 10,000. He's one of these leaders of a mega church. When you're with a big crowd of people, hearing a message from an evangelist has a different effect on you than it does if you were alone. So if joy exists, it will become intensified by the crowd. Going on, which, a quote from Shallit, says, it has been shown by some studies that a mirror in front of an aggressor tends to increase his aggression if he is disposed to be aggressive, even if this individual was not so disposed. The effect of the mirror would be to further enhance his non-aggressive tendencies. So the crowd is kind of like a mirror, and it will multiply whatever's being experienced, whether it be joy or aggression. However, if this individual is not so disposed, the effect of the mirror could be to further enhance his non-aggressive tendencies. The effect of the crowd seems to be much like a mirror, reflecting each individual's behavior and those around him, and thus intensifying the existing pattern of behavior. If you're ever in a situation where there's a natural calamity, catastrophe, get away from people as soon as you can. Okay. He had been an army officer in the South Pacific, and one night the Japanese launched an infiltration attack on his position. During the attack, a Japanese soldier charged him. "I had my .45 caliber pistol in my hand," he said, "and at the point of his bayonet was no farther than you are to me. When I shot him, after everything had settled down, I helped search his body, you know, for intelligence purposes, and I found a photograph." Then after a long pause, he continued. This is the author interviewing some World War II vet. "It was a picture of his wife and those two beautiful children. Ever since," and here tears began rolling down his cheeks, although his voice remained firm and steady, "I have been haunted by the thought of those beautiful children growing up without their father, because I murdered their daddy. I am not a young man anymore, and soon I will have to answer to my maker for what I have done." Now, this is exactly what I'm talking about. This is exactly why the white race, not the only reason, but a good reason why the white race is disappearing. What is this guy supposed to do? Let the Japanese guy gut him with the bayonet? And let his kids in the USA grow up without their father, so the Japanese children can grow up with their father? He's going to ever answer to his maker for what he's done? He didn't murder him. He killed him in war. I mean, if you want to bring God into the equation, the book of Ecclesiastes says there's a time for killing and a time for healing. If you want to be religious about it, the Bible says, "Thou shalt not murder." But killing in combat is not a sin if you're a Christian. And I can make the argument that we're the white race in combat right now. There's a war being waged against the white race right now. And I'm not telling anyone to go out there and do anything, and I'm not going to do anything, and I don't want any of the other radio hosts on resist.com to do anything. All I'm saying is that, philosophically speaking, I can make a pretty sound argument that the white race is under attack and that we should do whatever we need to do, including killing, and that we should feel no guilt for it. I don't mean to sound like a prick, but I'm really glad that this World War II generation is almost completely gone. My father served in this war. In fact, he served in the Pacific against the Japanese. He helped liberate the Philippine Islands, and I believe he was part of an occupying force in some part of Japan. I don't know if it was Okinawa or whatever. He never talked about his World War II experiences, but I'll tell you what. This is the type of mindset we need to get away from. The Japanese, they've interviewed Japanese soldiers from World War II. They interviewed Japanese soldiers who were part of the Bataan Death March. And they said they feel absolutely no guilt for what they've done. He said it was war, I did my duty, and that's all there is to it. I've seen Japanese soldiers who are old men now say through an interpreter that I feel no guilt for what I've done. No, it's always the white man that feels guilt. There's another war experience here. There was a lull in the battle during which Metelman, who was a German soldier, who was part of the occupying army on the Russian front, saw two Russians coming out of their foxhole. Now this is Metelman telling his story. I walked over towards them. They introduced themselves and offered me a cigarette. As a non-smoker, I thought, if they offer me a cigarette, I'll smoke it. But it was horrible stuff. I coughed, and later on, my mates, obviously, immigrated over to England, said, you made a horrible impression standing there with those two Russians coughing your head off. I talked to them and said that it was all right to come closer to the foxhole because there were three dead Russian soldiers lying there, and I, to my shame, had killed them. They wanted to get the dog tags off of them and the pay books, which is what their wallet. I kind of helped them, and we were all bending over, searching the bodies, and we found some photos in one of the pay books, and they showed them to me. We all stood there and looked at the photos. We shook our hands again, one patted me on the back, and they walked away. Metelman was called away to drive a half-track back to the field hospital. When he returned to the battlefield over an hour later, he found that the Germans had overrun the Russian position. And although there were some of his friends were killed, he found himself to be most concerned about what happened to those two Russians. "Oh, they got killed," they said. I said, "How did it happen?" "Oh, they didn't want to give in. And then we shouted at them to come out with their hands up, and they didn't. So one of us went over there with a tank and really got them and silenced them that way." My feeling was very sad. I had met them on a very human basis, on a camaraderie basis. They called me comrade, and at that moment, strange as it may seem, I was more sad that they had to die in this mad confrontation than my own comrades, and I still think sadly about it today. I'm amazed at some of the stories that these white men told, because you would never read that if that was a war between two non-white states. Or let's say it was non-whites running over a white position. No non-white soldier would walk up to two whites coming out of a foxhole and meet them on a human basis and, help them search the bodies and look at photographs and feel some remorse about what has taken place. You would never see that. We're so vastly different from non-whites that I can't even find a vocabulary to describe it. And the race that is the author of Higher Civilization, the best fucking literature on the planet, the most imaginative literature, is disappearing from the planet. In a new world order, and they're sellout white asses, think they're going to have just a great world with all their serfs are going to be black, brown, and yellow, and they're going to live high on the hog and live in their mansions with a world population no more than 500 million. They would rather sell us out to have that. The world majority should be made up of white people. Stories like this prove that we should be the racial majority on the planet. All right. Cultural distance, inferior forms of life. In the section Killing in America, we will examine the methodology a U.S. Navy psychiatrist developed to psychologically enable assassins for the U.S. Navy. this formula primarily involved classical conditioning and systemic desensitization using violent movies. But it also integrated cultural distance process in order to get the men to think of the potential enemies they will have to face as inferior forms of life, with films biased to present the enemy as less than human. The stupidity of local customs is ridiculed. Local personalities are presented as evil demagogues. And that is quoted in Peter Watson's War on the Mind. The Israeli research mentioned earlier indicates that the risk of death for a kidnapped victim is much greater if the victim remains hooded. If you don't take the hood off a victim, most likely if the hostage's demands aren't met, they're going to be he's going to be killed, because you dehumanize the person if you leave the hood on. If you take the hood off, you look in their eyes and they become human to you. So, once again, we come across that truth. Going on, it says, but the Nazis are hardly the only ones to wield the sword of racial and ethnic hatred in war. European imperial defeat and domination of darker races was facilitated by cultural distance factors. However, this can be a double-edged sword. Once oppressors begin to think of their victims as not being the same species, then their victims can accept and use that cultural distance to kill and oppress their colonial masters when they finally gain the upper hand. This double-edged sword is turned on the oppressors when colonial nations rose up in fierce insurrections such as the Sepoy Mutiny or the Mau Mau Uprising. I don't buy that. The non-whites, especially the black and brown, even if we were to treat them with the utmost, if there was any kind of overthrow of white society, don't count on them being merciful or compassionate. A lot of this stuff here has a false view of racial realities. So we always have to look at things from the prism of race, because that's the 800-pound gorilla in the room that nobody wants to talk about. And because nobody wants to talk about it, you know, it's the same as garbage in, garbage out. If you don't take into consideration of race, and you try to have some kind of mathematical formula, 2 plus 2 will not be 4. It'll be 5 or 6. And it's just going to mess everything up from there. The United States is comparatively an egalitarian nation, and therefore has a little more difficulty getting its population to wholeheartedly embrace wartime ethnic and racial hatreds. But in combat against Japan, we had an enemy so different, alien, that we were able to effectively implement cultural distance combined with a powerful dose of moral distance. Since we were avenging Pearl Harbor, thus, according to Stouffer's research, 44% of Americans in World War II said that they would really like to kill a Japanese soldier, while only 6% expressed that degree of enthusiasm for killing Germans. Well, that doesn't surprise me. In fact, I wonder about that 6%. Probably has some Semitic blood in them. It can be easy to unleash this genie of racial and ethnic hatred in order to facilitate killing in a time of war. It can be even more difficult to keep the cork in the bottle and completely restrain it. Once it is out and the war is over, the genie is not easily put back in the bottle. Such hatreds linger over the decades, even centuries. This can be seen in today in Lebanon and what was once Yugoslavia. Moral distance involves legitimizing oneself and one's cause. can generally be divided into two components. The first component usually is the determination and condemnation of the enemy's guilt, which of course must be punished or avenged. The other is the affirmation of the legality and legitimacy of one's own cause. Moral distance establishes that the enemy's cause is clearly wrong. His leaders are criminal, and his soldiers are either simply misguided or sharing in their leader's guilt. But the enemy is still a human, and killing him is an act of justice rather than the extermination that is often motivated by cultural distance. The establishment of the enemy's guilt and the need to punish or avenge is a fundamental and widely accepted justification for violence. Most nations reserve the right to administer capital punishment. And if a state directs a soldier to kill a criminal who is guilty of a sufficiently heinous crime, then the killing can be readily rationalized as nothing more than the administration of justice. The mechanism of punishment, justification, is so fundamental that it can sometimes be artificially manipulated. In World War II, some Japanese leaders cultivated an artificial punishment justification. Colonel Masanobu Tsuji says that Holmes, who wrote this book, I don't see the name in the book, but anyways, he said this Colonel Tsuji, who masterminded Japanese planning for the invasion of Malaysia, wrote a track designed, amongst other things, to screw his soldiers to a pitch of fighting fury. He says, quote, "When you encounter the enemy after landing, think of yourself as an avenger come face to face at last with your father's murderer. Here is the man whose death will lighten your heart of its burden of brooding anger. If you fail to destroy him utterly, you can never rest in peace." Well, we can say something like that too. We can say, when you encounter the black and browns after landing in the city, think of yourself as an avenging army come face to face with your mother and sister's rapist and your father's murderer. Here is a race whose death will lighten your heart of its burden of brooding anger. If you fail to wipe out this race and destroy them utterly, you can never rest in peace. I mean, you know, anyone can use that. And like I said, the Japanese felt absolutely no guilt for their activities in World War II. The Japanese never apologized to the Chinese for their atrocities at Nanking in 1937. I mean, there was a story of two Japanese captains seeing who could behead more people in an hour. And the other Japanese soldiers standing around laughing at this and watching them take bayonet practice with real Chinese citizens. You see, they have no mercy. They have absolutely no capacity for mercy or compassion. That's what we're dealing with here. And if the black man thinks his worst days are behind him when the white man disappears, he's wrong. One of the major manifestations of moral distance is what might be called the home court advantage. The moral advantage associated with defending one's own den, home, or nation has a long tradition that can be found in the animal kingdom as well. And it should not be neglected in assessing the impact of moral distance in empowering a nation's violence. Winston Churchill said that it is the primary right of men to die and kill for the land they live in, and to punish with exceptional severity all members of their own race who have warmed their hands at the invader's hearth. H-E-A-R-T-H, hearth, whatever that is. Moral distance processes tend to provide a foundation upon which other killing enabling processes can be built. In general, these are less likely to produce atrocities than cultural distance processes, and are more in keeping with the kind of rules deterring aggression and upholding individual human dignity. Okay. mechanical distancing. Remember I talked about with the shooting at the enemy, you know, 2,000 yards away using a night sight or a thermal imaging device? You don't see people. The infantry kills the enemy up close and personal, but in recent decades, the nature of this close-in battle has changed significantly. Until recently in the U.S. Army, the night sight was a rare and exotic piece of equipment. Now we fight primarily at night, and there is a thermal imaging device or a night vision device for almost every soldier. Thermal imagery sees the heat emitted from a body as if it were light. Thus, it works to see through rain, fog, and smoke, or permits you to perceive through camouflage, and it makes it possible to detect enemy soldiers deep in wood lines and vegetation that would have once been completely concealed them. Okay. We have seen before that when the enemy is fleeing or has his back turned, he is more likely to be killed. One reason for this is that in doing so, he has provided both means and opportunity for his opponent to kill without endangering himself. Easy to kill from the flank or the rear. The most obvious motive for killing in combat is the kill or be killed circumstance of self-defense or the defense of one's own friends. We have observed this factor many times in the case studies observed so far. Easy to kill. Yeah. See how much time I have left. Well, boys and girls, we're going to have to pick it up in another show. Like I said, this book on killing's got a lot of stuff in it. It's probably going to cover possibly 2 to 3 shows. So, we must secure the existence of our people and the future for white children. Carpe Noctem, seize the night, starve the sheep inside, and feed the wolf.